Hello, this is Scott Sykes, and I am pleased to welcome you to Voices from Appalachia, a new show that will feature oral histories from the Appalachian Oral History Project collection. This is a collection that was developed over several years, beginning in 1973, which sought to gather stories of lived experiences in this region, particularly in the area of Southwest Virginia. That collection is in the process of being digitized and curated in a publicly accessible online archive. This is work being done by Emory and Henry students, and I look forward to sharing many of those oral histories with you and to talking with community members and students about what we can learn and know about life here in this region as we listen to Voices from Appalachia. Welcome back. This is the second part of a conversation I had with Kathy Shearer. In 1973, as part of the Appalachian Oral History Project, Kathy spoke with Nancy Fullen Axon, a longtime resident of the Poor Valley community, and was able to record a powerful story passed down to Miss Axon from her grandparents. If you want to hear the first part of our conversation, I invite you to check out the podcast of this show on your favorite platform. Well, let's listen to the third and final sample from this interview that you did in 1973 as part of the Appalachian Oral History Project. If there can be a happy ending, we might say, there is a joyful part of this interview, and this is when this is the story that Miss Axon shared that day of her Aunt Sue's coming back.
And so Mama said one morning, after they moved away and Grandpa built a home and they lived back in Fannin Woods, said the grandmother was up getting breakfast, and all of them was in the house, and she's out there kidding. Then she comes to the door and says, Edmund, that's my granddaddy's name, Edmund Rue. Says, Susan's coming. He said, what are you talking about, Dilsey? She says, oh, I said, Susan's coming. He said, well, how do you know? Says, I recognize her voice. She's way down in the mountain, but she's on her way home because she's singing. He says, what's she singing? My head got wet with the midnight dew, and the morning stars is a witness too, and she was coming home to Grandma and Grandpa. She was sold away from them in slavery time. Mama said that's a song she was singing, and Grandmother recognized her voice. And he said, Grandpa asked her, say, how you know? And she said, I recognize her voice. And he asked, what is she singing? And she went on to tell him, my head got wet with the midnight dew, but the morning stars is a witness too. And she was on her way home that morning before Grandma got breakfast ready.
Yeah, that's so great.
I think any of us who live here and call this place home can picture a morning like that and can picture the ridges unfolding out in the distance with maybe fog in between them perhaps, and can envision that moment perhaps. Mm-hmm. That's moving to me. And to think of hearing the faint voice of that song being sung coming across the hollows and what that must have meant. I'm curious if you remember that moment when you were talking with her in 1973.
I remember it and thinking, wow, she came back. You know, where was she? You know, how did she make her way back? And the whole experience of sitting there with Nancy telling these stories, like it was one thing after the other of, wow, here I am, this little white girl, listening to this, you know, woman tell these stories about a life that's so different from anything I could imagine. But it was such a wonderful ending to a really grim story. Of course, we don't know what happened in between to Sue's. Mm-hmm. I think I have found her burial site, which is very close to where Aunt Nancy lived. And there is a headstone there for a Susan Fullen, which I think probably would be this woman. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't know anything about her life after she came back. But, just to think that she, and I love the idea that she was back there before breakfast was on the table.
You and I were talking a little bit about this before we started today, but you featured the lyrics of this song in your book, Working for Stewards. It's called Been in the Grave and Arose Again, which you cite as a very old revival hymn. Do you know much else about that song at all? We've been looking for it ourselves and haven't found it.
I don't, and I was just delighted to find it. That gives you a look at the difference in research between then and now. Because at the time, I just remembered that little line that she kept repeating, my head was wet with the midnight dew and the morning star was a witness too. And I thought, when I was working on this book, preparing it, I thought, I wonder if I could find something about that song. And so I just searched on the internet, and within 3 minutes, I had, you know, a version of it. And this one came from a collection of revival hymns and plantation melodies by Marshall W. Taylor in 1882. Mm-hmm. So that, and it's quotes, it uses those words in the song, and the title of the song has been in the grave and arose again. And I thought, wow, Nancy, you know, sometimes you interview people and you think, are they making this up? You know? Does right. it just come to them? And they just, because she was quite a talker, you know, she right. was energetic and she just loved telling these stories. But then to see it in print, to connect this with what she's telling, this made the story of Sue's returning even more poignant. You know, it's just, yeah, okay. Yeah. 1882 was the collection of the revival hymns, and that was collected many years after they were being sung, I'm sure.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it would be great to, I haven't learned any more about it, but with all of the good information that's out there, Scott, I'm sure you can.
You know, this is another very important piece that this interview offers us, that humanized understanding of what it must have meant to exist under such a brutal system like that, the way it would have impacted your family, and the joy that you two would have felt to hear that early one morning. So I think that is what really, again, makes this one of the more powerful interviews that we have in the collection.
Yeah, I love talking about this interview. It's when anybody asks me, I say, this is the most important one that I did. There are many others that have importance, have real meaning to me, but this one still just gets me. And that wonderful gathering that you helped with up in Marion, that was very special. And we got the word out, and folks came from Poor Valley who knew her, and you had let us know that you were going to be playing that interview, and that moment where you, or was it William Fields, asked anybody who knew, who was related to Aunt Nancy, to stand up, and how many people stood up?
I don't remember,
like,
Kathy.
20, 25, mostly white
least.
People.
Exactly, yeah. Which was another element that was a surprise and a new thing to me about the story. But the event you're referring to happened in 2019 yeah. at the Mount Pleasant Preservation right. Society, which was the old Mount Pleasant Methodist Church mm-hmm. there in Marion. And William Fields, as you mentioned, is the executive director of that organization. But Nancy Fullen was our draw that day. And we had a full house.
Yeah,
there was not
too.
A seat left in that building or in that sanctuary for that presentation. It shocked my students, by the way. This was the capstone of a research methods course that I had taught that semester. And the final project for those students was, as a team, to listen to some of these oral histories. We talked, of course, about the method of oral history and some of the questions and issues surrounding that, and then to put together a public presentation mm-hmm. of this very important material, which, again, was part of our conversation about the importance of research being participatory and including members of the community in a very active way. And I will never forget the looks on their faces when they turned around. We had been sitting at the front kind of beforehand as people filed in and were milling about, and one of them turned around and then turned back to me, and I remember his face going pale and him saying something to the effect of, there are a lot of people here. But they did a fine job,
I think.
They
did a great job.
That was a powerful moment. I'm glad we could do that with so many people.
Well, I have to give credit to Austin Stanley, this young fellow who grew up in Poor Valley, hearing about Aunt Nancy, as he calls her. He never knew her, because he was born after she'd already died. I mean, he's a young kid now, you know, college age, I guess. But he was the one, when I told him about it, he just really drummed up the support in the community. He said, come on, we've got to all go to Marion. We've got to find this place where they're having this conference, meeting. And he was thrilled, just thrilled.
It was a good day.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that was featured as part of that event, we had a poster for that event, if you recall, and the photograph of Nancy Fullan was the sort of background of that poster. It was her standing. I have it with me, and I wanted you to... I know you've seen it, but just to...
Yeah, that's the one I have in the book. Yeah,
so one of the treasures that is part of this collection is that there were a number of photographs taken of the people who were interviewed from everybody who did an interview. So we have hundreds. They're not all there, but hundreds of snapshots.
Oh, good, because I've never seen them.
Well, they're really interesting because many of them, most of them, are simply people just sitting on their couch in their living room or sitting on their front porch swing or standing by their garden and pointing to a plant they were proud of. And we're preserving those too. We're scanning those into digital files that will eventually be part of that digital collection that's publicly accessible. And I don't know much about that. It's interesting to me that as part of an oral history project, Dr. Stevenson would have directed people to take a snapshot too. So can you tell me a little bit about this picture? Did you take this snapshot?
I did not, no. That picture comes from, I'll try to remember, I can't remember her name. First name's Janice.
Okay, so this might have been a different day then.
Yeah, that was totally different, yeah.
That's
a much nicer camera than we would have had, probably.
Well, it was included in the file. So
it was.
That's why I presumed that.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't have it, so I don't wonder where that came from. Now, it's possible that the archivist... that I gave him that and he put it in. That's possible.
I see.
But basically, we had just real inexpensive little cameras. I think maybe I was thinking I had my own, but I don't know. But when I gave the cassette back to Dr. Stevenson, I always gave him the film, and we never saw the pictures because I just gave him the little roll of film, and that was the end of it. So I'm delighted that you have found the photographs because that was something the archivist could never find for me, because I kept saying, are you sure you don't see any photographs? He said, no photographs. So
we have a lot of them at some
great
point.
Are there names on the back identified?
Well,
or?
They're part of a file with that person's
name,
so we know exactly who they are.
Great.
And of course the date that it was taken.
Well, that all disappeared for a while then. It's been recovered.
It's not
probably
all
from
there.
A filing cabinet back
right
in a corner.
It came over and, you know, the library sent us over just boxes of materials, that was one of the things that we came across. So there's a big gap in the alphabet at some point, I forget where, somewhere toward the middle of files that are lost at this point, but we have a great many of them. And love looking at them because they're not necessarily posed. You can tell somebody just said, hey, can I take your picture very quickly?
Right.
And so you get these moments in time you catch glimpses or the pictures that were on their walls in their homes or the clothes that they're wearing and just the expressions on their face. Very few of them are sitting there smiling back at you. It's just kind of like a point of business in the interchange or the interaction. But they're fascinating to me. I love looking at them.
Good. Yeah. It may also be that they're a little shy uncomfortable. Because here you have, in many cases, probably someone who didn't graduate from high school, maybe only got to the sixth or seventh grade, in the case of the men particularly. And here they are being interviewed by a college student or somebody like myself, and it's just a little bit off-putting. Now, for Nancy, it wasn't, clearly. She was out there. I'm going to tell you my story, honey, darling, as she calls everybody. But I'd say for the others, it's a bit like, you know, like maybe I should have dressed up or something.
Right.
It'd be a little bit, yeah. But I found in my work that pictures are so important. In my books, which are, you know, huge, 550 pages here in this one, it's the pictures that draw my readers in, because a lot of my folks who have appreciated these books are not readers, typically. They don't get a book off the shelf and sit down and read. But the pictures, they look at the picture and then they think, oh, I got to learn more about this person, you know, or I used to know her. I bet I could tell you a story about her. And they, time after time, they'll tell me, I've looked at all the pictures and I've started reading the stories, you know. So it's really important.
It is. And that's a good turning point for our conversation, I think. You were involved for how long with the Oral History Project? Did you say a year?
I'm thinking a couple of years, maybe. Yeah. How long did it go on? Do you remember?
Well, that's unclear, a matter of debate. I think the overall project that involved the four schools, the best I can tell, was just the academic year of 1973 to 74. However, I don't know if this was a part of the program or not, but at the very least, Dr. Stevenson continued his end of things. Mm-hmm. And that's how we came to have such a large portion of the collection. I know of none of the other schools that have as much material as we have. Okay. But he also, of course, didn't just record oral histories. He would record things like a Board of Supervisors meeting or a Lyceum event or the inauguration of a college president. Oh. He seemed to just be fascinated with the technology and what it might offer in terms of record keeping, as you would expect an historian to do.
Right.
But that is something I wanted to spend some time talking with you about. It's just the Oral History Project itself. First of all, as we discussed earlier, Dr. George Stevenson is not a familiar name on this campus much anymore. There are only a few people who probably remember him. I just barely do. He was still alive when I was a student, and his reputation was still very much something that we knew about, just as a scholar and as an interesting person in many ways. I'm just wondering if you would care to share a few thoughts about Dr. Stevenson with us.
Well, meeting him at the library, as I did, getting to know him just a little bit that way, I was very pleased that he offered me this job part-time. And one of the reasons he offered it to me was that he figured I'd show up. and my work schedule was a little different from the students. But he just told me, as I said before, just go out there and find people, you know, just find people. And so when I found all these people with Mildred's help, and brought him back all these interviews, after a while, he contacted me and he said, I'd like you to start finding some other people that aren't so down at the heel. And I was really surprised because with my knowledge of the Foxfire Project and how important that was to capture this culture, which was rapidly leaving us as these folks died out, I thought, this is the really important stuff. But I know he directed me towards a woman who was the widow of one of the most important tobacco warehouses in Abingdon, and that I needed to go meet her. And I thought, oh boy, I'm going to have to change my wardrobe to do this. And I went, and she was very gracious, and we had a good interview, and then he encouraged me to do a few more like that. Let's get some of the Abingdon upper-ups here. Because they are part of the society. They are part of the culture, a totally different part of the culture.
Right.
But that was important to him. And so I did as he requested. And I never really saw the results. I did see the book that came out that was published.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see, I didn't continue in it to the extent of listening to anybody else's or see any of the digitized versions. I know that his wife worked very hard to transcribe them. And I, you know, there a lot of those are in that book, the title of which is...
Yeah, Kathy is referencing a book that came out in 1977 called Our Appalachia, mm-hmm. edited by Laurel Shackelford and Bill Weinberg. I always, when I talk about the Oral History Collection, bring a copy of this book with me to show people, because the Kelly Library has multiple copies of this book available mm-hmm. on the shelves. And it's one that if you have interest in, you should definitely check out.
And there also was a book published, and it's a paperback book, I believe, with the names of the different schools involved and lists, many lists of the interviews they did. That's mm-hmm. in the library as well.
Right.
It's more like a catalog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's that. But I didn't, because of the work that I was doing then went in a different direction, I didn't keep in touch with Dr. Stevenson about the project, and I thought pretty much it had come to an end. But I was real glad to be a part of it for a brief time. Yeah.
And beyond what you talked about with the conversation with him about going to find some wealthier folks or more at the other end of the spectrum in terms of socioeconomic situations, beyond that conversation with him, did he talk or say even in passing much about kind of his aims for the project? And the reason I ask that is because I felt, since I became responsible for this collection, almost like I'm on the trail of Dr. Stevenson and trying to sort out a lot of his motivations. And I'll come back to that in a little bit, but I'm curious if you had any conversations with him about those things.
I'm sure we did at the very beginning. I don't remember specifically, you know, that I think he was, they all the four schools were trying to emulate Foxfire, which was the leader at that time. Because when I knew Foxfire, that was, we were living in Georgia in 1969 and 70, and it was booming. You know, lots and lots of people were coming to the area because they'd read the stories. Mm-hmm. They had the books. And I think this may have been the spark for the Appalachian Oral History Project. And maybe it was going on in other places as well. But that's just my guess.
I see.
It was well publicized. And Appalachia was being rediscovered.
Exactly.
You know, it had been asleep for many years, way down there. People didn't know about it and didn't care. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, they have music. They have handcrafts, they have beautiful quilts and pottery. And they have this and they have a different way of talking. You know, all these things. They're unusual people down there. So I think this all came together at that point. And I feel that Dr. Stevenson just grabbed on, and he must have said to the college president, here's an opportunity for us to get together with these three other schools. Let's do it. And so whoever was the president at that time, I'm sorry, I don't remember.
No, I don't recall.
Must have said, fine, go for it. And they had to spend some money. They had to get the equipment for all of us to go out and do it and sign up the students and everything, assign credit for their work and all that. I don't know if they were, if the students were paid anything for this, if it was a paid job. But anyway, I don't remember having many conversations with him. I really don't. I'm sorry. I wish I'd interviewed him. Somebody needed to.
Yeah, and I think that's a little bit of the fascination and fun of it for me, the bit of intrigue, if you will. It is clear that he was going for a broad collection of people from different facets of life and with different experiences. That's clear. But it's also clear that he had some very specific questions himself, perhaps. At the very least, he had specific links. Or maybe he would come across a student who, you know, was from a particular place and he knew something about some issues there and would enlist them to do this work. For instance, there's a whole collection within the collection of oral histories that were done over in Fieldale that were about the attempts to unionize the textile mills over in that part of Virginia. This is a story that has not been told very much either. And I was actually able to track that student down who conducted those interviews. I think there were probably around 11 or 12 of those interviews, all with people who worked at the Fieldcrest plant in Fieldale. So it was clear that Dr. Stevenson had some interest in that issue, or he had happened to come across the student who was from there and had family members who had worked in that plant and said to him, go back and do this. Because I asked that gentleman what it was about. You know, was it a class project or was it just something that he did out of his own interest? And his response was, well, I really didn't think much about it at the time. In his case, it was a summer job. And Dr. Stevenson had offered him a small stipend to do this work and told him, just go back and interview family members. And it just so happens that this, you know, this young man at the time had a lot of family members who had worked in that plant. But you end up then with this whole, again, it's like a little corpus of material for one particular story. He also seemed to have some interest in particular coal towns that don't exist anymore. I'm thinking of Tom's Creek was a community that we have a lot of interviews from. He very clearly made an attempt to gather oral histories from the Blacksburg community just over the interstate from campus. So there were some things on his mind, you can tell.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
So do you remember approximately how many of these that you conducted yourself?
I don't. No, I don't. I would have to look through the catalog.
I'm sure I could determine that if I tried.
Right, I don't.
Well, we've spent a lot of time talking about the interview with Nancy Fullen Exon. Are there others that, after all this time, still stand out to you that you did?
Well, there's one other. I mean, there's so many that are good stories. But there's one with Dan Price that really impacted me. Dan Price also worked for Stewart's, and so I brought him back to life. He had passed away, too, and brought him back to life in my Stewart book. He worked for Stewart's on the Rich Mountain Farm, and in the 1920 census, he was 19, so he would have been born in 1901. And he told me this story, and I thought, wow, you know, how do you make a life doing this? He says, I came here from Russell County to work for Stewart Land and Cattle Company. I worked on fences, cut briars off the mountains, made 75 cents a day. That was so they could bring the log trains up there. I watched sheep, keep the dogs from killing them. I worked there just about all my life. They didn't pay you. They just give you an order for Elk Garden for the store. When we lived in the cove, it took all day to get over to Elk Garden, walking. Leave before daylight, and it was dark sometimes coming in. Carried what I got on my back. And since I was learning about the Stewart farms, you know, and knew the topography, knew the land, I know the house he lived in. After he moved off the farm, it was fairly close to where he'd lived when he worked for Stewart's. And, you know, just thinking of working for 75 cents a day, totally on foot, hiking up and down, cutting things, and then walking over to the store, which in this case means walking up over Clinch Mountain and down the other side to the store, the company store. It's just like a coal town, the company store in Elk Garden, where you turn in your record. So you show how many hours you worked. And so if you worked, you know, if you'd even worked 100 hours, you didn't get a whole lot. But it was just amazing to think of the work that people put in. And they just kept on doing it. So to me, this was, you know, here I am, you know, a recent college graduate, and I'm talking to a man who probably went to school. He said, I didn't go to school but just about 2 or 3 days when I was 18. Nobody in my family went back then. School was 2-3 miles away, and a lot of times in the winter, we didn't have coats to wear. You know, and you think, this is a different world.
Right.
Totally from the one I grew up in.
Yeah.
You know, just so different. So,
what a way for you to be introduced to the community.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I met him through another fellow I met who was a wonderful storyteller, Curry Holmes, and he introduced me to a lot of people. And he said, yeah, you need to meet so-and-so. He's got good stories. And I'll talk to so-and-so. He's got a real good one. <You know? laughs> So there is, in this area, we have some great storytellers. You know, nowadays, I think it's a little bit harder to meet them because you've got so much else going on in your lives. They're running around, they're driving cars, maybe. You know, they're riding on a motorcycle or something. But they're still here. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
They're still here. And I think the value of what you're doing, Scott, is so important for people to know. I wish, I've said this many times, I wish I had a dollar for every person who said to me, oh, I wish you'd met my mama before she passed, you know, and recorded her. And I tell everybody who says that, look, here you are with your cell phone, okay? You can just turn that on and record and do it now before they're gone or before their memories are gone.
Right.
Just do it now. Don't wait.
Yeah. Well, the value is very much these stories themselves and the time that these people gave and the willingness they had to share things from their own lives.
Yeah.
It just a tremendous, tremendous treasure, I think, that we have here. I'm wondering if you might share some parting thoughts about what you think are some of the things that this collection has to say to us 50 years later.
Well, certainly with your, you said you have several stories, several collections, several interviews from the Blacksburg community, which is something that is tied to this college. This is where Black people lived, as I understand it, in the very beginning of the days of this college, when the young fellows who came here had to do farm work or bring their enslaved people with them to do the farm work for them. And that's where they lived,
right,
eventually. I mean, that's a whole nother story to this college. And so the value of oral history is it uncovers layers that have been hidden often. And I think that's one of them, just like Nancy Fullen Axon's story, things you don't know. And another very important part is it brings people together, because sometimes people's stories pop out and someone's sitting there and they say, I never knew that. She never told me that. Mom never said a word about that. You know, things come out that need to be told, that need to be known. And I think it's wonderful for the students here to understand that in addition to the history that they're reading online typically, or they're hearing in a lecture, you've got the real voice behind that, that that really means something. And these people like Nancy are all gone now. Dan Price is gone. You know, but if you can listen to their voices, it's very impactful, more so than reading it in a document. I think it's just really wonderful to hear it. So I'm just delighted that this tradition's going on and that we're getting this out. I know that, I think it's Appalachian State, isn't it, that has put a lot of the interviews online.
They have some transcriptions. They, especially, I'll brag a little bit, compared to us, have very few. But they, as far as I knew, the last time I checked, just have the transcriptions in their digital collection.
Okay, not the oral part.
Not the audio part,
but
right.
But you're working on the audio.
We have, and it's available now.
Oh, it is.
Through our website, the Appalachian Center's website.
Oh, good.
You can listen to both audio and see the transcription at the same time.
Great.
And eventually we'll have those photographs in there as well.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. That's perfect.
This is a good opportunity to say that the students today, our Emory and Henry students, are doing this work. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who have done the work of digitizing the files and doing the archiving and the cataloging online.
Wondered, that's super. Yeah. I'm so glad. Yeah.
Well, when the idea started being discussed about this show where we could highlight the oral history collection and talk about some of them, immediately, I thought the first show that I wanted to do was with you. So it's been a delight. I really, really appreciate
you. I really appreciate that. It's a story that just lives on.
Yes.
I'm sad that we don't know of any heirs of Nancy's, any blood heirs, but I feel like we are. We have to keep that story going.
Well said. That's exactly right. I agree. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you, Scott.
Join us next time for Voices from Appalachia on Wednesdays at 1:30 here on WEHC Emory and WISC FM Wise.